Welcome everybody to the monthly member meeting of the Norwegian Unic User Group. I am very pleased to see so many people here. I will send a list of people attending so you can sign up to get the number and the number of people showing up, and also be able to put you on the announcement list if you're not already on it. After the meeting we will go to the Greek restaurant just above this building and have some drinks and a bit of food, so please join us if you want. For this meeting we have been very lucky to get one of the most vocal people in the Debian project to show up. He has written the Debian system book. He has proven himself to be a very valuable member of the Debian project, and I must admit that I'm a Debian developer too, so I get to interact with this person on a regular basis. I'm very pleased to welcome Martin Kraft.
Thank you, Peter. Good evening. Thanks also for my part for showing up in such large numbers. I'm very happy to be talking to you tonight, and my topic is beyond Debian, when the best distro just isn't good enough. I had to put those quotation marks around best because I actually don't want to be coming across the sort of Debian fanboy, arrogant person. Do tell me if I do, so that I can correct myself. Here's a little bit about me. I've been involved with the Debian project since 1997. I've been a developer for the last 5 years. I mainly concentrate nowadays on workflow and process integration, and also a little bit about quality assurance, just trying to keep the system at the standard that we've come used to it. I'm also a PhD student in Limerick in Ireland, and I research how you can get new methods diffused in the Debian project. So it's a little bit of sociology here, but also looking at Debian. And well, there's a little bit of more personal information, which I won't get into right now. So when this talk started with the idea of me going salmon fishing in Norway, and then it evolved into a talk here in Oslo. And when I was coming up with topics, there were a couple, and then Petter said, yeah, this is interesting, but not so much. And then I was like, okay, this one maybe. And then he was like, yeah, that sounds good. And then I chose that topic, Beyond Debian, and once we had it all published, then I was like, okay, so what am I going to tell you all about now? And in preparation of this talk, I then actually went out and did some research. And I talked to 3 other Debian developers, and I talked to 5 normal users and 2 users out of industry, and I talked to 1 Fedora developer, and I talked to 2 Gentoo preachers about what is missing from Debian. And the result, it's omnipotent, we can go home now, thank you very much. Okay, that one worked. So then I decided I'm just going to go and look at what I did the last 5 years with the Debian system, and how I used it and how I abused it to do the things that I needed it to do. I founded and I run madduck.net, which is a 23 server spanning global network for anyone basically. I have about 500 users, and they get whatever services they want. It's free of charge, there are no backups and no guarantees. But I haven't seen most of these servers, so there is a little bit of a danger here when you're sysadmining a server that's currently in Singapore, and there's no way you can get to Singapore if you actually screw up. And you will have 50 users screaming at you if you do. So there's a little bit of sysadmin experience that I have from that. I also maintain a 40-node cluster at an artificial intelligence laboratory, and that involves us basically giving root rights to students to these machines. So there are quite some interesting challenges here. And I was involved in the university mail server administration for about 250,000 mails per day. They were processing that, a total of 4 servers. So that's mostly my system administration experience, in addition to the Debian developer experience. And now this is what I want to talk to you today about, Beyond Debian. And I've split it up into 3 parts: system administration stuff, package related stuff, and the final point, what Debian cannot do. So without further ado, unless there are any questions, I'll dive into the first point. and I look at what it means for Debian to be a system for sysadmins. It's a very flexible system. It has universal tools and preserves your configuration, and it's extensible and has a, well, basically, it gives you all the power that you need as a system administrator. I feel like a marketing person now, I'm sorry, I shouldn't. The ideal of the system administrator is not to be doing anything, right? It's so that you can be lazy. You don't want to be system administrating, you just want to be sitting there and playing NetHack and having your systems work. And Debian sort of seems to be a good choice for that because of the aforementioned points. It is actually a system that gives you enough to do the system administration and then otherwise tries to stay out of your way. Unfortunately, our needs vary, and we cannot, even though Debian is called the universal operating system, we cannot cater for every single need. So there are surely going to be some things, some tasks, that you just can't solve. And I want to get into some of these now. Now, I also want to make sure that you know that this is really only from my perspective, and even though I have talked to a couple of people, part of my interest in this talk, to be honest, is to hear later on from you guys some of the things that aren't working for you, so that I can see whether they are already working and you just don't know it, or whether we can actually make them work. So there should be a two-way communication going on here. Let's have a look first at what you have to do with unpackaged software, with software that you have to install, which isn't in the Debian system, in the Debian package archive, because it's, for instance, non-free, and yet you have to install them. Examples of those, for instance, are Firewall One, Oracle, VMware, and all the various trunks that you may be tracking. You may be using, like, for instance, I track Git, the version control system. I just have the daily snapshot, and I have to somehow install that onto my Debian system to make sure that it doesn't interfere with the other parts of the system and that I can use it. That's sort of a prerequisite. So the standard steps for configuring those and installing those kind of software you see here, you have done them a couple of times, and I'm sure you've felt the effects of such a procedure polluting your user local. Or maybe you were entirely brave and you did prefix equals slash user make install, and you polluted your entire user hierarchy, and then later on had problems when it was about upgrading the software, or when two softwares like to install the same file and you didn't really have a package system taking care of it. So there's a little tool that I ended up using a lot, which is Stow. Which one, who of you is using Stow? That's one hand. There's going to be an explosion in the popularity contest for this package. So Stow is a very, very simple project. It's basically a manager of a symlink hierarchy. The concept is that you install your software to a subdirectory. Instead of saying, I install to user local, you install it to user local Stow, and then the name of the software. And then you invoke Stow on it. And what Stow does is simply take every single file that is in that subdirectory and create a symlink to that file from your user local hierarchy. And it is actually moderately smart about it, because now you can uninstall the software. Given that it had a set of files for which it created symlinks, it can use the same set of files which you installed into that subdirectory to delete those symlinks. And it's even smarter than that. It can prevent you from overwriting symlinks that have been installed by other software. So if you actually have to be using third-party software that isn't packaged in Debian, I heartily recommend you to use Stow. And it's very easy to use, even in scripts. For instance, I was mentioning that I was using Git, or tracking Git, the version control system, every day. This is my script. This is what I use. I simply pull Git, the newest version, then I actually delete the stowed information, or the stowed version of Git, before I then install it again and stow it again. The reason why I delete it is because Stow doesn't actually know to delete files that have since vanished from the directory to which you actually installed Git, so that you actually end up with some orphans if you don't do it that way. But it's very easy to use. I mean, it's just the Unix command, basically. I shouldn't be talking too much about this. There are also a couple of other pieces of software that you can use if you have to integrate your software or third-party software with a Debian system. And I listed a couple of those here. Those are probably the most important ones. There's, for instance, dpkg divert, which allows you to divert a file. It allows you to safely replace a file that has been installed by the Debian system. For instance, there was a time when PostFix didn't have TLS, and there was a time when PostFix didn't, when there wasn't a PostFix-TLS package. So if you actually wanted to have SSL or TLS tunneled mail communication with other servers, you needed to put other software in place. Now, the decision was between installing your entire own mail server in user local or just replacing one file in user lib. And if you replace that one file in user lib, then suddenly your PostFix could speak TLS. But it could only do that until the next upgrade of the PostFix package, because that package would then simply overwrite your file. And if you didn't pay attention, because you were doing that on a Friday afternoon at 4:55, just before going home, then for the next weekend, your PostFix didn't speak SSL anymore, which could have been slightly problematic. There's also update alternatives. I haven't actually used that in very much of a server context, but in a workstation, there was a time when Firefox in Debian was absolutely unusable, and you had to get the upstream version. And then the way that a browser, Firefox or any of the other browsers, is integrated in Debian is not necessarily via the name Mozilla Firefox, but via the also lovely canonical name Sensible-Browser. Whoever came up with that name for Firefox, don't ask me. Anyway, because Sensible Browser is being used by other parts of the system, I wanted to make sure that it was actually invoking my version of Firefox and not the packaged version of Firefox. So I used update alternatives, and I told the Debian alternative system that there is actually an alternative for the Firefox browser now available in user local. And then I could switch between that, those two, and I could make Sensible Browser point to those. The next two tools I actually put on there just for completeness, and you will notice there's it's supposed to be boldface, a don't after them. These two tools are for people who actually want to have Debian packages for the software that they install. So they have an external third-party software like Checkpoint Firewall 1, for instance, and they say, well, I love the Debian packaging system. Please let me integrate my third-party software with that Debian packaging system so that I can uninstall and track and get status information about the packages. And then there are these two wonderful tools which allow you to do that. The first one, dpkg repack, actually assumes that a deb package already exists. And once, in case you need to make any changes, which usually with third-party software you have to do, what it lets you do is you make these changes to the file system, to a file in user lib. You edit that file, and then you call dpkg repack, and it basically takes everything the package previously installed and puts it into a new package. And then you have a deb file. And if you install that deb file on another system, then you will get the software with your change installed. Now, the problem is that this dpkg repack only worries about files that exist or that don't exist. It doesn't actually worry about modified files. So if your Checkpoint Firewall 1 creates a user, then it modifies etc pass wd. And from the perspective of dpkg repack, that means that this file now has to go into the package, which from the perspective of dpkg means that if you now deinstall or upgrade the firewall, your etc pass wd file no longer belongs on the system and is deleted. You can seriously screw up your system with that. And check install basically is the Windows way of doing it. It's the clean sweep, I think, was the Windows application of doing this. Like, I'll monitor everything that you do during the installation, and then I record that in a Debian package. And it doesn't work the way that we want it to. One tool that, however, does work if you have to work with third-party software which provides RPMs or Slackware packages or Solaris packages is Alien. And with Alien, you can convert all your Slackware, Solaris, whatever packages into a dep file. And you then install that dep file on the system. And it has a benefit simply because the Debian system has a policy. This policy defines that no package must ever touch the files of another package. Now, an RPM packager doesn't care about the Debian policy. So if you install that RPM directly with RPM minus I and a file, it doesn't have access to the dpackage database of installed files, and it will just overwrite whatever is on the system. By converting it to a dep package, you're actually making sure that the dpackage process can consult the database just before installing and warn you or error and not overwrite the file so that the integrity of your system isn't put in danger. Are there any questions so far? Then let me hop on to the next point of system administration. You'll notice there's a couple of small points here now, just little tricks and hints that I came up with what you have to do because Debian doesn't actually do it. And one of these involves permission management. And I actually, in the description of this talk, I put my email address and I asked people to send me the problems they ran up with the Debian problem, Debian project. And the one of the responses that I got to that was someone wondering how to actually do permissions management. How can I cope with a daemon running as one user and the need for having a group of other people be able to edit the files that this daemon has to touch? And the solution to that problem is actually ACL. So I'm skipping ahead of slide here now. I'll go back to dpackage stat override in just a second. ACLs are actually common on every single Debian system now, and yet they're not being used by Debian, for one thing, and also they're not, in my experience, not very well known among system administrators. They give you the opportunity to have give multiple people access, including write access, to a certain set of files or an entire hierarchy. And it's a VFS, virtual file system feature, so every single one of the common file systems that you will be using has ACL support. Here's just a quick example of what I tend to do on most systems. Like, for instance, if I want to give a group webmasters access to the varlock Apache files, which Apache doesn't create by the group ADM, which should be the group that has access to these log files, but maybe I just want to have the webmasters, then these are the steps that I use. And as you'll see in the fourth line, the ls output, it has a little plus after the permissions and before the to. And that plus simply means there's additional information stored with that inode. And I can use get facl to get these additional informations. And you'll see the group webmasters has rwx access, but the effective access of that group is actually rx. So the webmasters cannot write to the log files. And that's very important. You don't want your webmasters to influence your web statistics, right? So there's actually another component coming in here, which is the mask. And it just, as you can see, it actually masks out the W. So you add those two together, and this is what you get, the effective rights. So another point in permissions management is that dpackage actually enforces permissions of the files that it installs. Similar to what we've been talking about earlier, it enforces the content. It will overwrite your files. It will also restore all the permissions. So one common example that I find on systems that have multiple users is when you don't trust libpam, which now has this feature to only enable access to a certain members of a certain group. If you don't trust PAM, then you might want to make your bin su. Well, just imagine there's a U over there and then a bin SU in the line above that. If you don't want to give access to bin SU to all your users, then you can set it to mode 4754, which basically is set UID. It allows root to override it. It allows the group wheel to execute it. and all the others can't. They can still read it, but they can't execute it. Now if you do this, the next time you update the login package, which includes bin.su, then dpackage will happily override those permissions again. And the way in which you can prevent dpackage from doing that is by telling it that, as a matter of fact, you actually want to be overriding the permissions here. And the tool for that is dpackage stat override, and you pass it basically the stat, the permissions of the file, and it'll register that in a database, and dpackage from now on will respect those changes. And whenever you install a new bin.su, it will be installed with the same permissions as the one we have here.
Do you know if that system has a, will make sure there is no race condition? If you, for example, need the permissions to be correct when the binary or the file is moved in place, will it enforce that? I know rsync is not, so we had a problem with the mail servers where the configuration file would have the wrong permissions for a few fractions of a second, and we would lose a few hundred emails.
I would tend to say no, to be honest. I just, the complexity of it, like first reading the database and then as is writing the files, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think later on the database just, it goes over the entire file system and makes sure that the permissions are correct.
Right.
So that would be a lovely bug actually to have. I mean, I agree with you fully. You will actually have users who can access bin.su during the time that you're updating it. But I will write this down. All right, so those two are rather basic points for now. Third-party software, which I'm sure everybody actually has to work with, especially in a production setting, and permissions management. Now, let me go to a third point, which is managing configuration with version control. I was kind of debating with myself whether I should put that in here, but given that is actually a child project of mine, and given that it's very fascinating and very useful, I decided to do it, so I hope you don't mind. Why would you ever want to keep etc under version control? Well, I hope I don't really have to go into the details of this. Version control allows you to A, restore any file to any revision that has ever existed before in the history since you started using the version control system, providing that you actually do the commits. And providing that you do actually do the commits, it also has logs for all the changes, and it has diffs for all the changes. So it's very useful, especially if you're working with multiple people as system administrators on a single system, when on Friday you look at your postfix configuration and you know it has been that, but on Monday you come back and it's different and you don't know what has changed. And you want to find out, and that's what version control can actually do for you. But I actually tried to use CBS at one point in time for etc management, and it resulted in a server in Philadelphia which didn't have an etc directory anymore. I had just made a backup, I still had an SSH connection, I got that server back up, but it was kind of the, I don't know what you call it, sysadmin adrenaline or something like that. It was very, very careful about every single keystroke that I did. None of the VCS, and that was kind of the problem that I had, VCS is version control systems. None of the version control systems that I know actually track permissions. So of course you can actually use them for etc tracking. It just means that your etc shadow is going to be world readable from now on. You might not care. If you do, then you can't use the version control systems. But there are a couple of alternatives, and the oldest of which that I actually ended up using is PHY soft update. How many of you have heard of PHY? That's the minority. PHY stands for Fully Automated Installations, and it's basically a way to quickly install a large number of machines which don't have to be equal, so it's a scripted install. It's like Red Hat's, what is it called?
Kickstart.
That's it. So like every operating system has that basically, but Debian's is called PHY. And over the last 2 years, PHY actually got the additional feature of a soft update, which means you don't have to take it down and reinstall it if you want to make a configuration change. you can just rerun the script. And I'm skipping ahead of myself here right now. I actually have a slide for that. And the way you do that is you keep those scripts now under version control. And then when you're done making your changes to the script, then you call Phi soft update, and it runs those scripts over your entire system again. That means that the scripts have to be idempotent, but CF Engine, which some of you may have used, or Puppet, or you know, even Perl and SH, can be made to be idempotent, to only make the change if it hasn't already been made. And that way actually works quite well. We have a couple of servers in the Debian project that we administer like this, and it involves an extra step. It makes testing difficult, but it also records more than just a change. It kind of records the intent to make a change, and it records the exact commands that are required to make a change. And I haven't actually ever used that information, but it's good to have it. There's a second piece of software that came out quite recently by one of the Debian opinion and leaders and change leaders, Joey Hess, who has been writing pretty much about 25% of the Debian system. He's responsible for Deb Helper and DebConf and pretty much a lot of the software that is being in use today to make packages. He wanted to address that problem, and he wanted to do it properly. And Joey is the kind of person that can churn out 10,000 Perl lines in one night, so he did. And etc keeper is a way to store your entire etc directory in Git, and it uses another software called MetaStore to track all the permissions and all the ownerships and group information on those files. Now there is also a race condition here. He doesn't care. because it will actually restore the files and then only run MetaStore over them. So it's very similar to what I think dpkg stat override does. But he makes up for it with features. Like he hooks in with the apt package tool and basically allows you to track all the changes that are made by a package. So now if you have a stable machine and there's a security update coming in and it actually requires you to change your configuration, which I can't imagine, but if it were to do that, then after apt finished installing the package, you would be prompted, please enter a log message for this change. And it could show you a diff and all that kind of stuff. So it's pretty advanced, and I haven't actually put it to use myself yet, but I figured that I should point it out, because I think this is a very good piece of software that might end up being used widely. Yes, Peter.
One interesting observation is that DBNEView, since version 3, has a similar system based on SVK that will commit every change during installation and every hour, so you can actually discover when certain changes were done.
Yeah.
I will look into the apt hook thing to get it after every package installation, but we already used it to find bugs in the installation,
yeah,
modifying files we shouldn't,
yeah,
and also provide history. But one thing I've discovered that concerns me is history and pruning of history. One thing is half a year of changes in etc. That's no problem. Will 6 years of history be a problem? Is there a way to like cut away and make only 1 year snapshots if there is more than 3 years since the change or something like that?
Get me started talking about Git, because I can talk another hour about Git.
Okay.
It can do that. We can talk about it later if you want.
Yeah.
There are ways. I don't know about subversion, but Git can do it. Just one quick point here, no modular tracking yet. What I mean with that is that what I would like to have is to track my postfix separately and track my Apache separately, and then later to be able to recombine them, like have another system that is supposed to take over web serving but not postfix, so I just pull in the module for web serving for Apache, and not the entire etc directory from that other server. So that I kind of keep them apart, and that I can maintain different systems, or the same configuration for different systems, the same web server configuration for different systems in one version control system using, for instance, branches. But etc keeper doesn't do that yet. It's also at version 0.02 or something like that, so there's still some time ahead. Here's what I've actually ended up using for the last couple of months, if not years. I'm using Git to manage, for instance, etc postfix, and I have a makefile in every single repository. Now that makefile gets executed every single time I push a change to that repository, which is very handy because I can readjust the permissions and I can do a postfix reload in the postfix case. It's very unhandy in terms of I cannot actually give any other person access to that, write access to that repository, any other person that I don't trust, simply because they have root access to the machine as soon as they can edit that makefile. Now that's a concern that etc keeper has as well, and any such solution will probably have, but I'm just reiterating it here because I actually had to battle with someone else over this point. But let me wrap it up here with version control for etc. If you're interested in this sort of stuff, there's a mailing list, VCS Home actually. It originated from the interest of keeping your entire home directory in a version control system. We're now more talking about keeping etc in the version control system, but it's sort of both of them are accepted. It's basically just general storage, file system storage in version control systems. So if you're interested, the slides will be available after this talk, and then you can get the URL to that. All right, I have two other quick last points here, and I'll just quickly run through them. I already mentioned PHY. If you're maintaining multiple systems, it's really a godsend. It allows you to do a lot of cool stuff very quickly. There are some other tools that I use with multiple systems. Apticron is one of them, for instance. That'll just send me an email when there are new packages available from the Debian archive. I find that really handy, rather than logging into every single one of the systems that I maintain every morning and checking whether there are security updates. Apticron will send it to me. Now, I have to say, of course, this is not an entirely secure solution. Somebody could be interfering with your mail server and preventing those mails from being sent out so that he or she can now exploit the security bug that the updated package for which these mails were sent is fixed. And mail is generally not a security tool. I actually end up using it a lot for security relevant stuff, but I also don't maintain bank information or anything of that sort. So it's quite all right for me. Apticron is very handy. Another tool that is incredibly handy, and I think it starts getting exponentially more handy the more systems above three that you have to maintain, is CSSH. Has anyone here used CSSH before? All right. CSSH is basically a way to control multiple machines via SSH. And what it does, or what it gives you the opportunity to do, is run the same command on any number of machines. You can group them, you can select a few machines out of your entire set, and it'll just run these commands. And for every single one of the machines, it opens an xterm. And it opens one additional xterm, which controls all of the machines. So in case you're running an upgrade, and the upgrade needs you to press Y at one point in time, then you can do that in every single one of the xterms. But let's say the upgrade finished on all the machines, and now you want to run one more command on all the machines. Or let's say you actually want to send that Y to every single one of the machines. That last window that is opened is a window where you can type something, and whatever you type is going to be sent to all machines at once. And that's incredibly handy. I'll leave it at that.
Two more systems that should be on that list.
Two more
software packages that should be on the list. App list changes. If you are a
Good
group
point.
Of people managing a lot of machines, you really want to know if someone else upgraded your machine.
Very good, yeah.
And the DSH. Distributed shell or dancer's shell or whatever. Which is like CSSH but without the terminals. And if you have 200 or 2,000 machines, you don't really want the terminals.
You should talk to your guest very much. He'll love the discussion. He has like 230 machines, and he needs the xterms that open. This is recorded, right? You talked about DSH now for a second. Let me quickly say app list changes. It's actually, you're very right, I left that out. It's a hook into the apt system, which gets run after the packages that are downloaded before they're installed. And one of the options that you have, for instance, is to send the change logs of the updated change logs, just the little stanzas that correspond to the upgrade, to a predefined email address, for instance, your administrator email at mailing list. And that way, it's literally impossible to upgrade a package and be ignored or not noticed by all the other system administrators. Now, of course, you could disable list changes before you do the upgrade and then re-enable it later and so on and so forth. But it's very helpful, not only because it actually keeps track of when the changes have been introduced, it's a little bit of a poor man's logbook in some sense if you keep all those mails, but it is also, it's very nice to just do apt-get upgrade and then see, okay, these are the changes that are about to be introduced. And then say, I actually don't want that, and say N and it doesn't do it. And that's very handy, rather than like, oh, something doesn't work anymore, let's see what new change logs have we got on the system. And so yeah, that's definitely a good package that I should include in these slides. And then backing up, I was thinking about putting backups on every single one of the slides that I was giving so far because of the importance of backups. And I could ask the question now, who of you is doing regular backups on the machine, but I won't. I'm just going to show you one tool that, if you don't know it yet, it's worth checking out, especially if you like the way that Debian does things. Backup Ninja is a program that's written by an American ISP, actually, and it works very much on a modular basis. It prepares your system for a backup. What I mean with that is that a backup usually isn't just a scan of your root file system and dump it somewhere else, because some of your data from PostgreSQL, for instance, may be in the cache and or in the RAM, and you might not actually get it if you just scan the file system. So in order to save something like a database or in order to save something like a mail spool, you need to snapshot it. And Backup Ninja provides modules for all these kind of different softwares, like PostgreSQL or MailDir or PostFix Spool, and snapshots them, puts them into one location, where later on, then your backup tool goes and fetches them. So it's actually only backup, it doesn't do restore. And I guess that there's actually a very important point to be made about you have to have a restore method, but if you can have either or, backup and restore, or just backup or none, backup is a very safe choice. It's better than none. So check it out. You might actually like it. And the way that, even just the way that you enable a module by putting a configuration place with the name of the module in place, which has all the configuration for that module, it's very, very elegant. I'll say that. All right. So I think this pretty much sums up what I have to say for system administration. I realize that it's everything or anything but complete, but let me move on because I don't have that much time available. When we come to packages, which is part of system administration on the Debian system for sure, there's often some problems that people perceive with Debian. Of course, there are good things, like Debian is so rock solid that you have to fire an entire brigade at them. At the systems in order to make it unstable. This is actually a quote from Slashdot. But what you hear way more commonly is that Debian is outdated on the day that it is released. Well, yeah, because we actually call it stable. And stable software doesn't fall from the sky. Now, I realize there are problems with Debian being outdated on the day of its release, specifically related to software that is more in flux than, for instance, your Emacs editor. That if it changes, it changes, but it's not necessarily something that needs to get on a stable system right now. But what about virus scanners? What about modern ways of spam filtering, which possibly haven't even existed by the time that Debian snapshotted what is later going to be stable a couple of months later? Well, the way that we address those is that we actually have a couple of additional archives in addition to the main archive. The security updates archive, most of you will know. I think it's installed by default on every single Debian system nowadays. And security updates are really just that. There's no way that a security update could provide you with a new spam filtering technique. It's very rigorous in that sense. And because it is so rigorous, it actually led to the creation of the Volatile Archive, which as of the release of Edge is now an official archive. The Volatile Archive is for volatile software, like virus scanners and spam filters, for instance. And it has very, very strict requirements as well. So you will not just get Spam Assassin 3.2 to replace Spam Assassin 2.3 from your current stable and then potentially have all the problems that you have because of the upgrade. You will get the new rule set adopted to meet the needs of the 2.3 version. So they're very strict about what they accept into Volatile, but less strict than the security people. Now, if Volatile is not enough for you, then you may actually want to look at backports. Backports are non-official, they're semi-official. Any single backported package will have been created by a Debian developer, or at least it will be checked by a Debian developer. But it's not a .debian.org domain, so it's not official. Backports basically solve the problem of new software being compiled against new libraries, which are not in stable. So if you actually want to get the new software installed on the system, then you have to upgrade your libc, which you don't want to do in a stable system. There's one other thing to be said before I show you a way to actually integrate other packages that don't use these, that don't come from these archives. These archives, the packages in these archives, make sure to integrate nicely with your current stable and also your next stable. What I mean with that is that the version number that is given to any of the packages is guaranteed to be between the version number of the current stable and the version number of the next stable release, so that you can easily upgrade to the next stable without actually having to remember that, yes, 12 months ago I installed a new Spam Assassin. Now that means I have to now install the newest of the Spam Assassins over that backported Spam Assassin. No, you don't have to do that. It'll integrate well with apt. But sometimes you actually can't do that. Sometimes you need software out of the unstable archive or out of the testing archive, and if only because backported it yet. The solution, of course, is just backport it yourself, but I'll get to that in a second. If you actually need to install unstable software or testing software on your stable system, then you can make use of something called pinning. You can actually make the entire unstable archive available to your stable system, but you need to make sure to pin your unstable archive to a lower priority than the stable archive, because otherwise the next upgrade will actually upgrade your system to unstable. And there are three ways to do that. You can either just specify default release in apt.conf, or you can edit apt preferences. You can also specify it on every single invocation with the -t option. And I'll just show you a quick example here. For instance, here is a common way of integrating Edge backports, backported software for Edge. You don't actually have to have the first stanza in there because it's already by default pinned to 1, which is a very, very low priority. And it means that the software is never going to be upgraded or installed automatically. So with MDADM, for instance, yes, I want to have version 2.6.2 installed, and I give it a pin priority of 600. And with MollyGuard, for instance, I want to always track whatever is in the backports archive. So I specify a different pin here, not the version, but the release, actually. And I give it a pin of 600, which means that now I'm actually going to track that software from backports. So you have to use pinning in order to install testing software and unstable software, but you actually also have to use it for backports because it's not official. Otherwise, you would be installing every single of the backported packages or upgrading to it. All right, so my last point for the day is when the Debian package does not meet your needs. And that could be the case, for instance, if you think that a different default setting should be in place, or you need different compilation flags, or There should be a second demon involved doing the stuff that your one demon is doing. It should just be doing it on a different port, slightly differently, with a different user. Or you need some other modification on a tool that's not in the Debian package. What do you do? Well, my take on it is, because this is Debian, you download the package, the source package, you make the changes to the source, you log your changes, you rebuild the package, and then you write a bug report with a patch and make a good case for it. Because recall what I said earlier, system administration is all about laziness, right? It's all about not doing stuff. If you have to track changes to packages across different releases or across versions of a package, you failed because you're not being lazy, right? What you really want to be doing is, if that is a change that is not only applicable to you, well, push it into Debian some way or another. Then, when the next release comes around, you don't have to worry about it anymore. It's there. Let me skip over pBuilder right now for a second. I'll get there in a second. I just said something about writing a bug and then pushing your change up to the Debian archive so you don't have to worry about it anymore. Well, here are a couple of tips that I think are very important when you want to get changes made in Debian. And they start with two documents. The first one being a really nice documentation about how to write effective bug reports. Basically, the doesn't work versus I have this system and I'm trying to do this and this is what's happening and I'm expecting this. Now, obviously, there's a slight difference between the information content between these two bug reports, and Simon actually tells you quite nicely what sort of information the developer wants or needs. Now, this is geared a lot towards users, and I imagine that you guys are possibly not the standard users that this is geared for, but give it a glance anyway. It has some good information. The second one is Eric's smart questions. That usually actually applies to mailing lists, but he has a couple of points in there which I think are very important when it comes to wishlist bugs, because in the end, writing to the mailing list with your problem and writing a wishlist bug is the same thing. It's like, I have a problem and you're supposed to help fix it or help me, right? And the way to do that is not by saying, it doesn't work, your software is crap. It works by being very polite and trying your best to make sure that the person understands that you appreciate what they're doing. And then you make a good case for what you want them to do. And then if that person actually understands the case, if you got it across nicely, then they will probably do it. So that was the next case. Why is your solution actually necessary? What does it fix? Why should the person even bother? There's a genuine interest, I assume, with every single developer, especially in open source, to make the software better. Now, you have to tell them that this is actually going to make the software better. Don't assume that they find out themselves. Also, don't change the package. Make it default off, whatever you add, which means also keep the patch to a minimum. Don't submit a patch that says, I prefer tabs over spaces, therefore this patch includes my feature and changes all your spaces to tabs. And it also helps to license your patch or just put it into public domain. If it actually gets accepted and it goes into a package like Firefox, there is some concerns about licenses around Firefox. And you can make sure that these concerns don't even arise by solving them before they arise. Let me just quickly go back to pBuilder. Somehow I managed to put that slide in slightly out of order. pBuilder, has anyone used pBuilder here before? Okay. pBuilder is basically truth management made easy. A truth is in this context, is an entirely separate installation of Debian. It runs on your kernel, but it has a different package database, which means you can freely install software there. You can even go into the truth and delete your etc passwd in a fit of rage or something, you know, when you just want to do it. And it'll forgive you. You can just delete or exit pBuilder and it'll all be fine again. But it also comes in very handy when you're building packages or you're changing them, specifically because you don't have to install all the build dependencies on your main system. You keep them in the tree, so it keeps your system clean. So I should put that slide in somewhere else. I hope it didn't confuse anyone. And this is, I guess, another slide in the slightly out of sequence, but we were just talking about pushing stuff back into Debian. And if you do that a couple of times, the question may arise, well, why should, maybe I should apply to become a Debian developer. And ask me 3 years ago, and I would have said, yeah, go for it, you know, it's just going to make your life easier. But a lot of things have actually changed in the Debian project for the better. Some things have changed in the Debian project for the better. So I can't really answer this question anymore the way that I used to. And now I think that you don't really have to become a Debian developer if what you want to be doing is just making changes to packages or maintaining your own packages. Because we actually have Aleph, which is our groupware server with version control systems. You don't actually need a Debian developer account anymore to interact with those. And we have a new status called the Debian maintainers. It's still in the process of being realized, but in the future, if you're the maintainer of a package, you can upload that package yourself. You don't need to go via a Debian developer to do the sponsorship. And that kind of alleviates a lot of the problems with people trying to help out Debian but not having developer status. So I think the only reason when you should be trying to become a developer, I guess, apply to become a developer because you will probably succeed, it just takes a little while, is that if you want to do stuff that crosses package lines, if you actually want to work on the entire distro, then it's really helpful. So I only put that slide in because I promised it in the description of the talk, and I actually went another way. But I guess that leaves me with the very last slide. I promise that is the very last slide. What Debian cannot do, and it's slightly empty, I realize that, but I did spend some time on it, and I tried to figure out what it can't do, and maybe my horizon is too limited, and that may well be the case, but so far, the only thing that I haven't found Debian to be able to do in the stuff that I had to do with Debian is what Gentoo is very good at, changing your compilation flags at runtime, without having to repackage your packages. Now, the three dots and the question marks are supposed to be my sign for the end of the talk and for questions. So if you have any points that you'd like to address or anything that you don't know how to do the Debian way or something that you'd like to see fixed, maybe you want to speak up now. Wait for a minute. After a minute, this is proven. Debian is omnipotent.
Could of course bring up the Debian EDU problem. That's pre-configuring packages that should be working out of the box, integrated well to each other during installation. It's still a work in progress.
Yeah. Pre-configuring of packages. Well, you said working out of the box, right? Because it does work.
Oh, yeah.
Assuming that what you mean with configuration is depconf answers.
Yeah, that works.
That works. But, so, what?
Well, if you want to enable the TCP listening on the syskaylogd, it doesn't.
And how does Debian edu address it?
We edit the file after the installation.
With CF Engine or something like that.
We break upgrades, but that's how we fix it.
Is this really something that the Debian package management system should do?
Well, personally, I believe that the package should provide a depconf, hidden depconf questions to configure it during installation, so we could enable that feature when we need it. So yes, I think the Debian packages should provide that.
Okay, so that's, in your case, I think that's a bug report, right? Wishlist bug. That
3 years old.
Oh, I think so. Who's that? Oh, Joey Schultz. Okay.
We only have 7 packages left with those kind of problems. But
okay.
It's hard problems. LDAP configuration, for example, crosses 4 or 5 packages, and you have to get it right.
Yeah.
So.
That's true, and I guess one of the problems what Debian doesn't do is it doesn't provide you with 1,000 developers who are equally responsive or happy to fix bugs. And I don't know, and I don't want to, you know, it's just Klock maintainer. It's not that I don't want to slay him or anything. It's the common problem in volunteer projects, I guess, and especially with Debian, where you actually, it's somebody at one point in time called Debian the Bazaar of Cathedrals. It's like, this is the way it is. Sysklog is a package that is under control by one guy. That guy happens to be incredibly useful to the project because he does so many other things, so he doesn't have any time for Sysklogd. I have a couple of wishlist bugs in Sysklogd I'm just thinking of. They're rather old. And they also involve DevConf, that's for sure. But it's a cathedral, so you can't just hijack the package. You might endanger the social dynamics of the project, but yeah, I guess in that case, have you actually tried to announce a forced NNU?
Well, I don't want to go into details with that because it's not a given problem with that packet as such. It's several packages. We have tried different approaches, and we are making progress. As I said, it's only 7 packages left. Yeah. There used to be like 25, 30. So there is progress, but we are still not there yet.
Yeah. Well, that's a difficult one, that's for sure. What I was saying earlier, forced NMUs, that's basically when somebody steps up and says, I'm really annoyed at this now. Here's the entire fixed package, and it is going to the archive in 10 days. Now you have 10 days to do something about it, or complain, even just raise your voice and I'll take it out. But if you don't say anything, which is what unresponsive maintainers generally do, then it'll just go to the archive, and then it's done, committed. And that works pretty well, because in the end, I don't think that any of the, or I don't actually know any maintainers anymore who maliciously try not to do something in Debian. So it's really just that they're overworked, and you might just, which is, I guess, why the last point of the, what do you do if the package doesn't do what you want, the last point is actually, don't just write that wishlist bug. You know, you could include that change. I didn't actually make that explicit. I wanted to say, create the patch and attach the patch to your wishlist bug, because then you're seriously taking work off the Debian maintainer. And if you've already solved it, then you kind of have to solve it if you know that it's the right solution. Then you're going to save a lot of time. Are there any other questions? All right, well, it doesn't look like it. As I understood, Petter, we're going for food anyway, so if there are any questions later on, then pester me. And of course, I did actually do actually have my email address in here somewhere. If you do have any questions after this talk, as I said, these slides are going to be available, so you're going to have my email address. Go ahead and mail me if there's something that I said which is unclear. That doesn't necessarily mean I will be user support from now on. The mailing lists are much better at that. But I've been in talks where I've been like, yeah, he said something like that, and I don't remember what it is. So if you encounter a moment like that, drop me a line. And otherwise, thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much. Small glass beer.
Oh. Thanks.
So the video will be available soon, and the slides will be available sooner, as soon as we can get them on the FTP site. Please join us for the restaurant, and remember, next month we will have hopefully Klaus Knopper showing up and talking about Linux for blind people. Thank you.